Thank you, everybody, for joining us today. My name is Zalmi Klein. I'm with Northmark Capital. Today we have with us Alexander Apfel, Managing Director and Principal from Concord Capital Partners, Curtis Cullen, the Managing Principal of Convolo Capital, David Berneman, Chief Executive Officer of Golden Bee Properties, Sagiv Rosano, Managing Principal in Roman Group, and Enrique Huerta, Principal of Rockview Capital. We have seen a lot of sponsors focusing on value add over the last cycle using floating rate loans. Now that floating rate loans are no longer competitive, how are you guys looking, I'll start with you, Alex, at new acquisitions? Are you looking at specifically only looking at floating rate deals? Are you still considering, are you only looking at fixed rate options? Or are you still considering floating rate?
Great questions, Almi. First of all, great to see you again. Now, it's kind of tough answering this question because you're our go-to mortgage broker, so really I could turn this back to you. But that being said...
You need to start buying more.
Exactly. That being said, in terms of floating rate versus fixed, I think, you know, we view today's floating rate, we honestly always did, even in the height of COVID when it was cheaper, quote unquote, at least in the short term, but certainly now we view floating rate loans similar to the way we've always viewed hard money loans, right? That's essentially what they are at this point. That being said, just like with hard money loans, if the return supports it, then we'll certainly look at it. For the most part, on the value add deals we're looking at, assuming that they're not distressed, we're looking at fixed rate loans in the 50 to 65 LTV range, depending on overall yield. But you know, there are a few deals we're looking at that are severely distressed, where we expect extreme upside and very high octane returns. On those deals, we're happy to look at floating rate. And you know, we capitalize for it. It's painful because it's expensive and the fees are super high, but you know, for the right deal, it makes sense.
Curtis? Yeah, you know, I kind of look at you know, our certain providers and partners as guardrails, and one of them is your insurer, one of them is your lender, and one of them is your investors. And just right now with the cap rate costs killing some cash flow, that will limit the investor that wants quarterly distributions. And so they're kind of boxing us in as value add syndicators into a medium term, you know, five rate or 5 year IO agency financing. We're at 65% LTV, and we were there kind of before it was cool, but now it seems to be the place to be.
Yeah, it's an interesting question. We were high on debt funds in the last 2 years, looking at, you know, upping the leverage. Our investor base was really interested in the model, and it actually worked pretty well in terms of underwriting. But at this point, given the market conditions we're in today, we're looking at deals only on a fixed rate basis. As the last panel was just talking about, Dan Katz from Brightspire, one of our lenders, for example, you know, that debt fund market is just tough to deal with at the moment. It's dried up in general. There are some that are out there. Their spreads are much wider than they used to be, so you got that problem to deal with. Plus, our investor base just is not, you know, keen on going into a floating rate environment in today's day. So our underwriting on any new deal, value add deal, has been basically focusing on fixed rate debt, agency or whatnot, then looking at the equity side to roll into the CapEx and sort of equitizing all the CapEx work that we were otherwise doing. So it's a little bit of a shift in kind of how we looked at things over the last 2 years.
We are in the same boat as everyone else. I don't think floating rate products are something we're interested in today. When we first started looking at deals this year, we were looking at doing synthetic fixed rate deals, so floating rate with really tight caps, but just realized that's gotten cost prohibitive. So we're looking at everything from a 5-year fixed rate perspective, but we're looking at our hold periods as 10-year. So ideally, we'd like to do 2 5-year fixed rate loans so we can possibly capture some lower rates if that happens, but we're a believer that this is a fundamental reset to real estate prior to the pandemic. So from that perspective, we want to play it a little safer, and you know, it's the most popular girl at the dance, 5-year fixed rate debt.
Yeah, I think I agree with you, Enrique. If you're buying an apartment building at a 6 cap right now, right, and you're trying to finance it with a 10% interest rate, and you're going to have to absorb it for at least 2 years. It's insanity. So I think even though it gives you the leverage, you can't lever right now as much anyways. Even those bridge guys are kind of stopping you at like a 60, 65. So you might as well go agency.
That's right.
We are actually have been looking at a lot of like older loans, to assumable loans. I think this is a very interesting strategy. They're a little bit overpriced, but if the loan is long enough, and depending on where you're feeling about rates, you're going to have some room there, I think.
So on that point, like, you know, cap rates are up, you know, 100, 150 basis points across where they were. But with interest rates on a fixed rate side, you know, and agency is kind of around the 6%, banks are in the high sixes. How are you making deals pencil with the negative leverage? See, even if you're buying a six cap, you're still, your cost of debt is much higher and, you know, expenses are up. So how are you making that pencil?
Look, we're looking at deals a little bit differently. We buy mostly LA rent control product. We need to be able to grow rental, like to grow our cap rate, like at least 200 basis points if we even want to think about it. I think there's very little in the market right now that make sense like that. And I see, at least in my market, I'm talking about LA, San Diego, I see kind of two markets, right? I see the Santa Monica, Beverly Hills trading at the mid four caps, people that are buying it to just buy against treasuries. And I see South LA trading at an eight cap, which financeable, right? Positive leverage. So that's what we're seeing. We're actually, unfortunately, not in both of those markets. So we haven't been active as much.
Yeah, I'd say in general, I think to your point, it's a tough market right now to be looking at any kind of deals where you're looking at cap rates going in and even a six cap, where you're financing at a fix at a 6.5 or a high sixes. It just doesn't really pencil. I mean, the only way that it could potentially pencil is if you're looking at it, like you were saying, a long-term strategy, more of a 10-year hold, or you're looking at, you know, something happening where you've got a value-add component that's unique, rent-stabilized product, where you're actually marking to market to substantially increase the rents as you go over time, and you're actually able to move tenants out, get new tenants to come in, and you know, you're going at a 100% increase in the rent that was previously there. If you can underwrite for that kind of scenario over a longer period of time, and you're willing to take that negative arb for that short period, then yeah, it's a potential doable deal. But your investors have to be willing to go on for the ride.
Curtis, are you guys looking at any pref or mezz scenarios to fill the gap on the fixed rate side?
Probably not the best person to kick that to, because no, we're not at this time.
Okay. Enrique, you want to jump in on that?
So it's a great question. When we first started looking at deals, we actually considered taking on that kind of equity or debt on top of the senior. And really decided, like someone said earlier, it's just cost prohibitive, too expensive, and really realized it was more of an opportunity. So we struggling to find direct acquisitions that make sense, right? We really don't want any more than 12 months of negative leverage. So ideally, to be in that position, you need a six cap with a 5-year fixed rate debt with a buy down, and you're still going to have some negative leverage for a while. So we actually pivoted and decided, in addition to buying real estate, we're going to be that kind of provider. So we've been looking at a lot of ground up new construction, providing pref equity in that $1 to $5 million space, which is very unique in that most groups want to provide capital from 10 to 50 million or more. And so right now we're looking at several deals, both new construction, but also existing operators who have troubled assets that need money for all the usual things that I'm sure everyone has heard about this year: cash and refinances, rate cap purchases, term extensions, things like that, cash in for the refis. And so we're looking at a deal in the Southeast. One sponsor, several assets. They need about 17 to 20 million collectively for several assets to really just right size their balance sheet and their capital stack. That's a compelling opportunity. And so rather than pay that money, we've decided to, put it out and then pay that to our investors. And so what we're seeing in that space is anywhere from a low to mid-teen current pay on new construction and about a 50-50 accrual/current on the existing assets. So that's a space that's pretty compelling, and I think more and more operators are going to start realizing they need that capital going forward if they are, in fact, going to hold on to their assets that are troubled today.
I can add to that. Like, I can see that, because I do intermediary on equity, and not a lot of people want to do common. Like, that's everybody right. Want to do a mezz or pref. We're in the market for like a $7.5 million mezz piece, pref piece in a Marriott hotel in Santa Barbara. It's not my deal, but like I think it's an amazing deal. We can't find LPs for that. Like all the LPs want to do pref, which probably were the way to go anyways at this point.
Yeah, I mean, I think we're seeing that also on the brokerage side. Borrowers coming in for JV requests, and we're talking to our equity providers, and the equity providers are like, yeah, we're interested, we're putting out money. And then the conversation goes from, hey, yeah, it's a good deal, we want to put in, we'll give you pref. We don't want to put JV in, we'll just, it's a great deal, we like it, but we're, you know, pivoting and they're putting it in on the pref position. They want to just protect the downside risk. But Enrique, on that note, you know, on the smaller preferred equity side, you know, putting in pref behind, how are you getting comfortable with lenders or the banks? You know, smaller institutions are not structured, they're not set up to, you know, to handle that.
Most of the lenders we're dealing with are balance sheet lenders. So they have, most of the time, they're also specialized in the product type that we're doing. So they don't have a lot of exposure to office, retail, and other troubled spaces like that. And we're also very focused on, you know, product quality. So we're very focused on the real estate itself. These are deals that are very nice. Both the senior and we like them together. And we like to partner with the senior lenders. We don't necessarily sit aside from them and try to have conflicts in the rights and all that kind of thing. It's more so cooperating with them to create a solution with those sponsors for the nice real estate so that they can fix the balance sheet that's broken while the asset is doing just fine, generally speaking. As soon as they get rid of that expensive money that's floating rate, they'll be in a much better position. So it's really just being extremely selective with the deal and the lender themselves, right? So there's a lot of lenders that they just won't put out money today, and we don't want to spend too much time with those folks until they decide they're back in the market. And that's really it. So focus on specialty lenders that have balance sheet capital, and they're not privy to a lot of the issues that were just being discussed on the last panel.
Another big topic is rent growth, and we're seeing, you know, rents decline in different parts of the country. How are you guys underwriting rent growth, Alex, in different markets? And, you know, what is that? Assuming you're still considering floating rate loans on, you know, these opportunities that you feel are correct and you can handle the high coupon, how are you guys underwriting rent growth?
Sure. So I think obviously it depends on the market and on the submarket. Certain markets or submarkets where, you know, there's a specific story with Fortune 500 company moving in or multiple companies moving in, allowing for extended rent growth. So there you can get a little bit more aggressive. I think in general, you know, looking at deals, and we're all sponsors here, if you underwrite limited or no rent growth for the next 2-3 years, you're almost going to have an impossible time underwriting a deal or penciling a deal. So if you're going to underwrite what some people are afraid of, then may as well just put your pencils down, right? But in terms of rent growth, historically, throughout downturns or historically over 5 and 10 year periods, we end up seeing trends in rent growth. And we look at market by market what those trends have been over the last 20 to 25 years, whatever data we have available. So we've been pretty consistent in sticking to, we were never guys underwriting 10, 15, or even 9 or 8% rent growth, even in the good years of the last 3 years. We stick to 3 to 4% if it's a great market. So we've been sticking to that, but ultimately, we're very cognizant of the fact that everyone's aware there is a downtrend in rents, and we're not going to buy a deal based on trended rents. So like you were mentioning before, it really only makes sense if there's a true value add component. So unless we see a strong mark to market, we're not just going to say, okay, we have enough trended rent growth that over a 7-year hold, we'll be successful. Because if we have 2-3 years of stagnant rent growth, there goes your whole return. So we're pretty aware of that, and we're not relying on it.
We like to get pretty granular with the job growth story in the local market. So, you know, the traditional answer in underwriting was, you know, 3% rent growth, 2% expense growth. Anyone who's underwritten a deal in the past year or looked at a T12 knows that that's, both are unrealistic today, right?
Upside down.
Yeah. But, you know, really, like one of our properties, you know, we look at the Southeast as a good opportunity. It's kind of a bright spot in an otherwise bleak landscape in terms of there's a real renaissance in like EV manufacturing, batteries and whatnot, and car manufacturing in the Southeast. So like one of our properties is in Commerce, Georgia. It's a town of 7,000, and SK Battery, which is an international EV battery maker, you know, putting in a plant that employs like four to 5,000 people. Stanton, Tennessee, outside of Memphis, Ford is gonna make EVs there as well. That's a town of 700, right? So anywhere you can go where it's a secondary, tertiary market where they're going to come in and bring thousands of jobs, I think that's where it's safe to assume higher than the 3% rent growth, because you're going to see that. And you can also support that with data to your investors and your LPs and sell that story.
Yeah, I think at this point, underwriting any deal north of a 3% rent growth going forward for the next couple of years is unwise. I mean, I think across most markets, that would be the case. We're going to be the lucky winners in the city of LA, though, of getting a 7% bump come next year. So we're excited for that one for the first time in 4 years. So that we know is coming. But in terms of underwriting for anything other than that, I would stick to a straight 3%. The other form of analysis that we've been doing on new deals is kind of looking at, like Alex was saying, you know, looking at this sort of untrended rent growth and kind of where our yields can be on an untrended basis on a new deal. And our target is 6.5% or north. If we can get to an untrended yield on cost, 6.5% or north, we're in an okay spot, I think. But getting there is still kind of tough. So underwriting any deal for that is even a hard sell at this point.
Amen to that. We've seen this fascinating concept that wasn't around for a long time called gain to lease on a lot of the rent rolls of deals today. And I think what Curtis was saying is just focusing in on the submarket, right, the job story there, as well as the just the actual supply story. We're focused a lot in Albuquerque, Phoenix, Vegas, and selectively in Southern California. And of course, the supply story, if you read the headlines, is very scary, but you'll also recognize if you dig a lot deeper that it's very concentrated in certain pockets. Now, of course, there will be some contagion and it will spread to the entire MSA, and we have seen that. So we're very focused again on effective rents, not gross top-level rents. And then secondly, as he was just mentioning, is the untrended yield on cost compared to our, you know, trended yield on cost. And if we can get comfortable with that, I think we're in the same boat, 6.5% plus. That seems to make sense. If we go further, like into the southeast, we'd like to be north of 7, just because there's more risk and things like that from our perspective. And I think if you hit that number, you're generally going to be okay, right? Because you're going to be higher than your long-term cost of debt. And that's really the fundamental, you know, I guess, rule of thumb in real estate is your cost of capital should be lower than your yield. And if that's the case, you'll be okay long-term. And I think we all know if we look at a pro forma long enough, usually 5, 6, 7 years, you will get to that position, right? I think we all just got a little spoiled over the last couple years with the quick turnarounds, but the fundamentals remain here. So as long as you're getting to that untrended number, I think we'll all be in a good place.
I think there's two things that are playing here. One, I think inflation is slowing down. So I think in general, you're going to get less rent growth. In our market, we cover LA, San Diego market. So we're going to get the 7% increase. We're pretty excited about that. So we're actually modeling it into some deals that we're looking to buy. Other than that, we're modeling a flat year this year. We managed 750 units. So I can tell you that our occupancy went down a little bit, but we're managing in the LA market. So we're filling up those units fairly fast, but we don't have a bidding war anymore. So flat this year, growth of 3% in the following year. So that's how we're modeling, and a 7% if we're on the units that are below market. Love
it. You know, so kind of with that flat rent growth and expenses going up, are you any, you know, David, I'll start with you, any way to get creative on income, RUBS or, you know, cable, any way to get creative and grow your NOI in the reverse?
Yeah, we've been instituting a few new sort of concepts. We've been doing some bulk cable contracts wherein we effectively partner with the local cable operator, internet provider, whatnot, and we'll be basically charged for the entirety of the building, and then we'll go ahead and actually do an arbitrage and we'll charge the tenants for that service. It's kind of a win-win for our tenants and us. We get charged, for example, $35 per unit per month for, you know, basic internet and cable and whatnot, and we'll go ahead and we'll charge the tenants, say, $60 to $70 per month. That's still cheaper than the actual tenant is paying if they went directly to Spectrum, let's say, and paid $80 a month. So it's kind of a win-win-win, allows for additional cash flow to us. That's one concept. The other is we've been starting to charge renter's insurance, and there's an arbitrage there where we're being charged $10 by the renter's insurance provider. And we charge the tenant $14. So again, a nominal kind of increase on a per unit basis. So little tweaks, little things like that. RUBS is also one that we instituted a couple years back. and really tried to get kind of bullish on pushing the envelope with trying to pass along the utility bills to the tenants where possible. It's a little tough, not always easy, especially in legacy scenarios where we've got rent-controlled environments and whatnot, but slowly but surely we're able to add yield by instituting more of a RUBS policy across the board. So those are a few, but there are others out there. I know others use different sort of systems to increase NOI.
We actually thought about like putting chargers in our building and make like a delta on the electricity. I think that's going to be kind of the next big wave. So we're looking at those. You know, obviously the cost of those things going to, but it's worth it, I think.
Yeah, I think we've, you know, I look at it. The other income increases more so on our current portfolio versus new acquisitions, because it's ultimately what we generally see is other income represents anywhere between, I don't know, 7% and 14% of your net residential income, your net rental income, call it. So it's not super impactful to your bottom line. I mean, if you're relying on that to make or break a deal, it's kind of tough. But in our current portfolio, we instituted a few months ago on our last asset we had owned in Dallas, like you were mentioning, just the little things. I mean, even we kind of overlook, you know, the pest control charges, sometimes valet trash charges, where you're charging $5 and maybe you can charge 13. And across 300-400 units, it makes a big difference. And you do that 3 or 4 times pretty quickly on a cap rate basis. You might add $1 million or $2 million in value on a few bucks a month that most tenants, when they've already been increased 20-30% over the last few years, and where the same tenant might have been paying $1,000 a few years ago is paying $1,250, $1,300, they can stomach another $10, $20, $30 a month in these other income charges. They don't really think about it, just like when we get a utility bill. One month it's $100, and the next month it might be $200 here in California, but you stomach it and you move forward. So even in these workforce housing demographics on a lower scale, they can stomach those extra income charges, and it makes a big difference to your bottom line. We did it, proved it out, and we sold it to the next buyer, and they bought it, and it worked out. So,
yeah. EDUs was a hot topic. Is that still part of a play in any of the business plans?
Sorry,
ADUs.
ADUs.
We've done ADUs in almost all our portfolio. They're a pain in the butt, but of course, like you know, we're happy with the income. If you're starting an ADU project, you can talk to me. I'll tell you how much pain it's going to be, but I think it's worth it ultimately. Yeah, it just, the problem is that we used before we financed those ADUs with our banks, and now that you're going to have to kind of come out of pocket, that's something to think about.
Yeah, we've been doing ADU projects for about 5 years now, or maybe a little less, 4 years, whenever it first started out in the multifamily space in the city of Los Angeles and in Long Beach and in Inglewood. So we've become well-versed in it. And as you said, yes, definitely a pain in the butt, no doubt. A lot of different layers to it. But it is a major value-add component of our business, or has been on a lot of our recent deals the last couple of years. We're in the midst right now, for example, of adding 18 ADUs to a 200-unit apartment in Sylmar in the San Fernando Valley. And it's very complex. I mean, you've got a lot of layers to it. It's almost harder than new construction in a lot of ways, just given the fact that you've got certain constraints physically to deal with. Then you've got, you know, parking issues and other sorts of things, and dealing with the utilities to actually turn on. I mean, I've got 2 ADUs in Long Beach that are fully done, and they haven't been set up with SoCal Edison for the last 6 months. So we're sitting here, sitting ducks, waiting for that whole process just to be finished in order to actually get tenants in the door. So it's little things like that that become a pain in the butt. But that all said, it is a way to look at value-add deals, has been over the past couple of years, and I would say over the next couple of years definitely will be, because it may only be the way in which deals can actually pencil, where you've got this negative arb we were just talking about. At least if you're adding units and it's costing you, say, $200,000 a door to add that unit, and it's worth $300,000 a door, well, that arbitrage right there is what's giving you the value and the pop in the deal in the long run. So it may be the way in which deals actually can only get done.
So on that point, anybody doing construction, focusing on construction projects, given, you know, where construction prices are, or getting creative, given that it's harder to pencil value add deals today, the high interest rates?
No.
Yeah, we've definitely taken a look, I think, but it just hasn't. We just haven't got there yet.
We have, actually. We've sort of shifted our model most recently. As I just mentioned, the value add deals are a little tougher to pencil. So about a year and a half ago, we started looking at some ground up deals in the city of LA. We focus mainly on workforce and affordable housing type projects. And so the financing market, unlike what the last panel just stated, the financing market for those strict affordable deals is actually still available and quite competitive in today's rates. So we're focusing on two new ground-up deals, one in South LA, one in Long Beach, that hopefully we'll get going here in the next couple of months.
We're not developers, but interested in providing capital to developers.
We're in one project that is 138 units in North Hollywood, and slowly this project is like it's not impossible to pencil, so it's an issue.
Yeah, the only thing I'd say to add to David's point is that we have one project that's we are entitled for regular market rate development in a really good part of town in LA, and now with ED1 passing, that has made it more interesting to potentially go affordable, a lot more density, more height. More units, and just, you know, potentially we make it into a LIHTC deal, get the tax credits, and get the affordable financing. So it is interesting, but I think barring that, typical market rate units are very difficult to develop today.
Yeah, I think to your point, I mean, I see a lot of market rate developers that are sort of shifting their angle into the affordable space and kind of, you know, butting heads with us on deals and looking at things that they wouldn't otherwise be looking at. But I get it. I mean, the market rate space is tough to do and ground up right now. But the affordable space is definitely out there. I mean, this particular deal, the one in South LA, I mean, we're getting bond financing from CalHFA, and it's really, really interesting financing that wouldn't otherwise be available to a market rate type deal.
Is that the bond financing that?
It's a recycled bond program, yeah. So it's Greystone is the one that's sort of managing the process, and it's very interesting. I mean, we're getting at 72% loan to cost, a fixed rate deal, 7 years IO. It's a kind of a construction to mini perm type scenario, so we don't have any real stabilization risk. So we're really intrigued by this. And I think that there are other developers that have been doing this for quite some time. We focused on the last couple of years mainly on the value add space, so we weren't as aware, but now it's becoming more prominent.
But that's not the program where you're partnering with a housing authority that owns the property.
No, that's, and yet you're right. There's another program just like that, and I think Avanath just did, where they bought the Baldwin Hills portfolio, right, where you could you know, go out of your way to actually deed restrict the units for 55 years, and at that point you're getting a, you know, affordability covenants, and so you're actually able to get better financing.
I love that. Sounds great. What kind of demand are you guys seeing in the market for, you know, BC class assets, given where, you know, expenses are, given where operation expenses have gone up, and, you know, the lower tier properties generally cost more to operate? Mm-hmm. Are you still investing in BC workforce housing, or are you more focused your shift to higher end, you know, class A? So Gabe, we'll start with you.
Look, I think the C market is what I see trading, at least right now, because if you're buying an 8 cap in South LA, like the one you financed recently, it actually makes sense, you know. But it's hard to make sense of a deal in Koreatown at a 6.5 or even at a 6. So I think the C market, you'll see a lot of movement there, and you see, as I said, the decent movement in the A plus market, the Santa Monica's and the Beverly Hills of the world. So yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, I mean, some of those tougher deals Sagiv is talking about, we're financing 70% leverage. It's all positive cash flow going in day one, which is kind of rare using a 6.5% rate.
So that's, to Sagiv's point, the majority of the assets we've seen trade in the markets we cover are C properties. And I think this market for the next couple of years will be what I call a barbell market. There's going to continue to be C product, and then we're going to see some A product trade. But I feel like a lot of people want to hold on to their quality late 80s, early 90s, early 2000s product if they can, because those are the middle market, you know, workforce housing assets that always do very well, regardless of economic climate. So the C stuff we like. We're starting to see 6+ caps in most markets. But the concern is basically what you mentioned. Are these real 6 caps once you account for, you know, 20% insurance cost increases or more, as well as just eroding rents, higher delinquency possibly with these, you know, depleting savings, increasing credit card balances, student loan repayments resuming? All those things are things we're factoring. So even if it looks like a 6, we think it's more like a real 5.5 cap. And I just don't think that's worth getting out of bed for on a C property. So we'd much rather be in the B space or the A space, and that obviously presents its own set of risks, but we would look there. I just think we're a little higher on the going-in yield because we think after year one it's going to be much lower rather than how it should be, much higher.
We've got mostly our portfolio is B and C product. We've got a couple of assets actually currently on the market for sale, smaller assets in South LA and Long Beach. And there actually are some buyers coming to the table, 1031 folks, high net worth individuals who are ready to deploy. I think maybe, you know, 5-6 months ago that would not have been the case. I think people are finally coming back to the table and saying, all right, we're in this world, we got to live with it, and, you know, I got to deploy my capital into something and get the tax benefits of investing in real estate. So we're seeing still some demand. Now, that could be a byproduct of also not having much you know, product on the market. So maybe we're just seeing it because we're the only ones out there. I don't know. But but yeah, I think there is still demand for the product. I think that it's definitely going to be more in that C bucket than the B bucket, just given sort of where potential rent growth will be in that C bucket over the next couple of years, especially in a rent-stabilized environment. But yeah, I think there's demand for it.
Yeah, I'll just say, add that you know, our last purchase that we closed a month ago was solid Class B, but 4-bedroom units. The entire community was 4-bedroom units, and it kind of falls into that BTR category. And I think the only thing that keeps it from Class A is the finishes and amenities. That's kind of where we've moved to, is buying directly from the developer or newer stuff in the Sun Belt markets that has been recently built for, you know, larger families and larger communities. And I think, you know, a year ago, we were not getting into best and final in the bidding wars and whatnot, and now this year, we're seeing deals come back to us that fell out from a previous buyer. We were runner up, we were number two, number three, and then the listing broker comes back to us a couple months later and says, "Hey, are you still interested?" So there's definitely still demand out there for the Class B product, and that's what we've seen.
So could you add and upgrade the finishes and, you know, add a little more to the unit to make them Class A units, or is it just not worth it in those tertiary markets?
You know, I mean, finishes, absolutely, you can swap out. I think the way that the communities are built, they don't have the space, the physical space to add amenities like some of the, you know, Class A stuff that was built over the past decade that you've seen. So I'd say finishes, yes, you can absolutely swap out and make it pencil. If you're in those submarkets that have the rent growth, right, that can support it, the ROI on your renovations, but not on the amenity side.
Zalmi, I think it's interesting because I think you could probably speak to this a bunch, but because you're in touch with equity providers, sponsors across the board, there's an interesting reversal that we're seeing in a trend that usually happens and has certainly happened over the last, call it 5 to 10 years, certainly in the last 5 years, as we were getting near the peak of the last bull cycle, where the spread between Class A returns and Class B and C returns has tightened, right? Shrunk to the point where you're almost not getting any more reward for going for a 70s or 80s vintage, certainly not even 60s, then you may as well go for the Class B and the Class A, safer bet, safer product type, less, you know, of a headache in terms of operations. And now over the last, maybe even the last 6 to 8 months, it was kind of steady for the most of 2022, but I would say from the beginning of 2023, you're starting to see that spread widen, where you are getting paid. If you're willing to roll your sleeves up and take on a 60s vintage asset in a Sunbelt market, you're gonna get paid for it. You're gonna be buying a high five, low six, maybe today a mid six cap. And if you get lucky and there's distress and you hang on tight, you might get even more, right? And you really can get those deals done. I was talking to a broker in DFW where it got to the point with a deal that he was marketing, there were offers in the low six cap range. And eventually he told his seller, "I don't even know if you offered it at a seven cap if someone will buy it." So then that was a 60s vintage asset. So it really ends up depending on the investor type and return profile, right? If you're private capital who believes in real estate in both the short and long term, and you want aggressive high octane returns, you can go into 60s and 70s and be paid for those returns for that risk where you weren't paid for that 2-3 years ago. Whereas in the Class A space, if you're, you know, private equity shop, institution, you want the Class A quality, but unfortunately the returns that you're looking for, even on the core plus side, you're not really getting today, given where cap rates are and interest rates are. So you want a core plus return, you're buying a core plus asset, but you're really getting core returns if you're being conservative. So it's interesting. I think there is demand for both. On the larger check size, there's more demand for the core and core plus stuff, but I think that's not trading as much because the returns don't pencil. But for capital that's ready to roll their sleeves up and believes in older workforce housing, you get bang for your buck, and it really makes a lot of sense.
But I want to mention something. There is definitely a clear flight to quality, mm-hmm. because if I'm an LP, why would I go to your stinky Class B mm-hmm. when I can go to a Class A and enjoy almost like, you know, maybe I'll take a little bit less of a yield. But I think that there is a flight to quality. We haven't talked about it that much, but there is. I think there is just like people either going to quality or to lower quality.
Sure. No, it's a big divide. And again, it's flight to quality, but that might mean what's realistically a 9% return versus a value add deal. If you get it done right and you have the right timing with the tenure, which is, God help us all, it's kind of tough, you might get to 19% or 20% return. It's a big difference, right?
Anecdotally, on the Class A stuff in the markets we cover, we're seeing 20 plus offers, so it is very competitive. But on the Class C stuff, 3 to 5 if they're lucky.
Right.
And I would say of the 3 to 5, there's only one. But if I were an investment sales broker, all it takes is one, right? So that's kind of the flight to quality that we've seen that as well.
Yeah, I mean, and going into that point is, you know, from financing, from, you know, we're all talking about financing being, you know, the issue with interest rates. A lot of banks have fallen off and, you know, are no longer financing. They're having problems with their balance sheet. They're having problems with liquidity. And I would say, especially locally in Southern California, you probably have about 8 lenders fall apart and no longer lend, and it's bank lenders, that is. And then, which were very competitive. They were competing with agencies. They were super competitive on pricing, super competitive on closing and keeping things simple and flex on the prepay structure. So now when you look at a deal, are you only looking at an agency execution? Are you still talking to a bank? And is there, you know, a lot of banks are requiring deposits. Does that change the way you look at a deal?
On our end, we're talking to agencies as well as the credit unions, because we do like our size is kind of fit that bucket. I think there's still lenders out there, but it's very difficult. You know, there's no competitive lending, really. Like, if you're going to a lender and actually saying yes, you're like, that's what it is. That's the offer you have. So,
I mean, there's not a lot of competition for the banks to step up, right?
Yeah.
It kind of, it's like, here's our quote, take it or leave it.
Yeah.
And we want 20% deposits.
Yeah.
Agency only, selectively, life insurance companies for nicer product, but that's really it.
I mean, I think you know the answer to this better than me, but for us, it's a matter of basically agency is our first line of defense at this stage. You know, in our underwriting, it kind of makes sense to go that route. A lot of our regional banks either are no longer in the business of giving new deals or even underwriting deals. They've kind of put pencils down. So they're out. And then that goes back to the debt fund question. You know, some of those folks that were talking in the last panel, you know, do those floating rate deals actually work? For the most part, no. So we're sort of stuck. You know, from a financing perspective, it's a tough time right now.
Yeah, I mean, I think you find the debt to match the business plan that you have. And, you know, similar to other income and the ADU questions that we've had on this panel is, like, previously, you know, the basic blocking and tackling of operating multifamily is, you know, staying on top of market rents and good operations. And, you know, how often are you doing rent surveys? You know, should be weekly or otherwise. And I think, you know, the questions of other income, ADU, and then I know this is a debt question, but if you're not looking at everything, then you're probably not, you're doing a disservice to yourself or your company or your investors. So previously, whereas you maybe it was a cursory look or a tertiary look, you know, now it needs to be a hard look at all the options to find value where it's available. So more homework.
Yeah, I don't have much to add. I think we're all pretty much in the same boat. The only thing I would add is that when it comes to banks, and we haven't executed with a bank in about a year now, but that last execution and the one prior to that, we had two bank executions over the last 18 months. They were both completely relationship driven, meaning if there wasn't a relationship, it never would have worked. So we're not testing the bank market, but we'll go to our direct relationship or partners of ours, direct relationships. And sometimes those terms can be better and are better than dealing with other lenders, especially because on the servicing side, it's a lot simpler and a lot smoother. So we would love to, you know, work with a bank even with a slightly higher rate, but obviously today it's just a lot less competitive and not that interesting.
Yeah, I would add that a lot of banks are, even the ones that are lending, are holding funds and kind of you reserving money for their key borrowers and not just putting out money as a new, you know, just a loan and not a full relationship. I would say that we've seen that more than ever in the last 8 months. We have a couple questions I'll jump into really quickly here. I'll start with the ADU question. You mentioned ADUs, David, is for you. In your opinion, what is the most optimal size for ADU size in bedrooms?
Generally speaking, we've gone smaller You know, studios and one bedrooms is our primary focus. Not to say you shouldn't try for twos and threes and fours, but we just feel adding units on a per unit basis, the value makes more sense. So if we're going in and, you know, adding in a studio, we can get $1,200 and it costs us, you know, $150,000 to do it. The value overall on that, you know, on that unit, once we go and sell it, is closer to $250 to $300. You know, the arbitrage between that smaller unit and that bigger unit isn't worthy of necessarily building to a bigger unit. So in our view, it's kind of keeping it to the studios and ones.
To improve NOI, would charging monthly rent for parking and also additional storage viable?
Yes.
I think charging for anything is viable, right?
Generally speaking, yeah. I mean, in the rent-controlled environment in the city of LA, it's a little tough on the parking side, but definitely where storage is available, we do try and charge for that.
Yeah, we try to be really creative. You know, we're also in rent-controlled environment in LA and in all over California, really. Yeah. We try to be creative and stick it to the tenants.
It's interesting because I'm curious your experience. We have a building, a rent control building in LA, perfect basement set up for implementing storage. And before building it out and doing it really nicely, we wanted to make sure there was demand from tenants. We sent notices, reached out to all the tenants, and we didn't get a lot of demand. So I'm curious if you're in your rent control buildings, call it Koreatown, Westlake, Hollywood, in these areas, if you're getting demand for storage, because we didn't see it.
So I think to your point, I think it depends on specifically where it is, sub-geography. Right. So we actually are in the midst of building out in Long Beach, in a basement type scenario where we're building out 35 individual cages.
Sure.
So storage cages, we're going to be charging those. We've got a lot of interest in those. So, you know, I guess it depends on where you are. And maybe it also depends on the unit types, right? If you've got mostly, say, two-bedroom, three-bedroom units, you've got families and whatnot, maybe they have more of a need for it versus, you know, studios and ones. I don't know. It could be that, too.
So we offer our storage as a kind of like as an entry to the building for free for the first 3 months. Mm. Then we stick it to the tenant.
Yeah, and I'll just add from...
Leases on that?
Sorry?
Do you do a separate lease on that to
I don't remember. I think it's in the lease.
I mean, a lot of drivers of storage are driven to people moving, and there's just not a lot of folks moving right now. So I think if you track the data of how many renewals versus unit turns you're getting, and once people start moving again, you know, who knows when that'll happen, but I think you'll have more demand for storage then.
And I'll finish off with this last question because we're running out of time here. Fixed rate deals today coming out of, you know, existing loans, you're looking to refi. And a lot of deals that maybe even you did 5 years ago was in a 4.5% interest rate environment. Today with rates, you know, the agency's around 6%, the banks, you know, in the higher sixes, are you seeing deals that need cash in, and does it make sense? Would you let your rate float if, you know, some of the floating rate loans have a ceiling at 8.5%, 9%, depending when it was originated, you just keep your coupon at 9% instead of putting cash in.
Yikes.
At a, you know, 6.5%. Right.
I'm a big blend and extend believer. Yeah. I think that's the way to go right now. Like as I think the previous panel said, your best lender is your current lender. Having conversation with them, we actually just got an extension of an IO. So we had a loan that was originated 2 years ago. IO period was over. We called our lender. We said, listen, this property is cash flowing to perfection right now, at 1-to-1. That, you know, on IO. So live it the way it is before you piss me off. And they backed off. So
it's that's a bridge loan?
It's an IO for another 6 months, we'll see.
It's a bridge loan?
What?
Is that an existing bridge loan?
Yeah.
Well, luckily, we don't have any trouble legacy assets, but I would say, you know, if we were in that position, we had exhausted all options, you believe in the asset, you want to do right by your investors, and you want to preserve the housing, obviously it makes sense to explore your options. And I like what Saqib said, focus on your current lender. They, I think, just like everyone else, are your friend, want to help you succeed. And so that's probably the best place to start. But if not, then, you know, give us a call.
Yeah, I mean, we've got a variety of assets that have floating rate debt that's coming to maturity or, you know, rate cap situation next year. So we've got a variety of situations where we've got to make some tough decisions. I think for the most part, though, to what the previous panel said, we will be working with our existing lenders to likely extend those, pay the rate cap, you know, and extend for another year. These are heavy lift value add deals that still have a lot of room to grow in terms of ADU additions and unit turns and whatnot. So we're likely going to continue with the business strategy and hold out and hope that, you know, in two or so years we'll be in a position to then exit or refi into some sort of agency financing.
Yeah, I would just say an old playoff of Sam Zell's survive to 95 is survive to 2025 right now. And I would say, if we're looking at doing that, it's, I wish I had a graphic that'd show up on the screen of the 5 year this year, because the volatility has been, over 100 bips throughout the year, where it doesn't make sense in January, it doesn't make sense in March, it doesn't make sense in May, it does make sense in July. So, I mean, like, really the question, the conversation I would have with a lender on doing that is like, okay, how fast can we do this? Because it better be like, 6 weeks from flash to bang.
I would say, needless to say, it's a case-by-case basis, right? We've had some floating rate deals where we executed a swap, and that's what made sense for us, take some risk off the table. Obviously, we're locked in and heavy prepay penalties if rates do come down, but in terms of risk for investors, that's what we felt was the best thing. But again, speaking to what I mentioned before, just relationships are so important. We had a deal that we executed well in the business plan, but of course, interest rates shot up over 200 basis points from where we expected them to be at the execution of that plan. And we took it out with a bank loan that was completely relationship-driven. No other bank would have gotten anywhere near those proceeds and those terms. Zalmi knows it. This last deal we did. And that's, that's how we were able to get out of that one, and we executed a cash-neutral refi. So I think it's, the relationship component is exactly what Sagiv was saying, working with your current lender, right? If you have a good relationship with your current lender, usually you'll be able to get something done. If you have another lender with a relationship, that works too.
Thank you, everybody. Thank you to the panel. Great job.